Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our regular dive into the news stories that have been making the headlines over these past couple of weeks. And with me are two men who are grieving. John Stevens, our National Director, grieving that England have lost the Ashes. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Phil.
And Justin Gill, our IT manager, grieving that the Tories lost two by-elections last week, one in Yorkshire and one down in Devon. Good morning, Justin.
Good morning.
Justin's our IT manager, and he's going to be giving us some insights into that from the point of view of the Conservative Party a little bit later.
Phil, Basball nearly did succeed.
It nearly did.
Old Trafford, it was nearly there. In the end, it was the British weather. The Australians retained the Ashes due to the British weather, but it was a stunning performance by the England team.
Well, the Australians down under in their commentary on that match have got some slightly different views about Basball, if you were to give it a read. But there we are. 2 weeks ago, we had Rachel Sloane in the chair, and that has been vacated to allow Justin to be with us today. And it's worth saying Rachel's currently helping on Contagious Christian Camp. So give us an idea of some of the things that are going on, John, that FIEC staff are involved in and things that are happening over the summer.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, FIEC Central is a sort of a quieter period for us. Lots of people are taking holidays, but that doesn't mean it's a quieter period for our churches and for gospel ministry. Actually, this is a remarkable period for gospel ministry. The summer is a time in which there are large numbers of camps, holiday Bible clubs in churches, evangelistic opportunities, beach missions going on all around the country, and loads of our churches are involved in those at various levels. My own kids are coming back from a local church camp that they've been at for this week. We're then off to Keswick tomorrow. And again, our kids are going to be involved in the youth work there. Some of our kids from church are at Contagious kind of north up in Barnard's Castle, which is just brilliant. And again, that's replicated all across the country. And it's just wonderful to hear about young people who are being given actually firm biblical roots for their faith. I think for young people, it's such a massive challenge to live in our culture at the moment. They're under so much pressure. And just that wonderful benefit of being together with other Christians, having a sense that they're very isolated at school. They may be on their own, only a couple of Christian friends. And suddenly they're in a group of, you know, a couple of hundred people who are believers. That has huge impact on helping them to be clear in their faith. It's an opportunity to perhaps reflect on some of the big issues that they're facing. And then, of course, it's evangelism as well. Many kind of summer camps are times at which people kind of come to real faith in the Lord Jesus. They might have grown up in Christian homes, but it's often an opportunity where they really realize and understand the gospel and believe. The majority of people still become Christians under the age of 25, many under the age of 18. And then particularly evangelistic work. There are sort of lots of camps that there are people go to who maybe jog along to a church youth group but aren't believers. Mm. Camp is a place where they kind of, in a sense, have a greater opportunity to hear the gospel and are impacted by it. I think particularly beach missions, which have a real evangelistic element to them as at seaside towns around the country. Mm. Sort of teams are working on the beach, trying to kind of build relationships, share the gospel with kids and with their parents. So it's a really fruitful time, I think, for evangelistic ministry and growing the next generation, which is crucial to the future of the church. So we're having a slightly quieter time, and in many of our churches, it's active gospel ministry that's of huge significance. And we centrally are praying for them. We were praying at our staff meeting kind of yesterday for that work of camps and house parties. Trevor Archer led us to kind of make that the focus of our prayers, and we were delighted to do so.
Justin, you've been helping churches think about reaching Muslims as well during this period.
Yeah, so I've been kind of had an opportunity to go around and basically connect with churches who are locally in their area trying to reach out to Muslims. It comes with lots of challenges. And it's really good to know the challenges that they're facing. And recently, Daniel Grimbate, who's our recently appointed or joined in FIEC as the local director for Yorkshire, he organized a get-together of evangelists in Yorkshire who were trying to reach out to Muslims. And it was a really good gathering to know that what challenges they are as evangelists they face and what are the difficulties there. And I think, one of the key things that came up was that the evangelists, there's a disconnect between what evangelists are doing and what the church leadership want to do. So there's a kind of a disconnect. So probably that's something that then in future days, something to talk about.
Yeah, in terms of how it sort of fits with the wider ministry of the church rather than people working in different silos.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's lots of disconnects and stuff, but that gathering really helped the evangelists from across different denominations and including some FIEC churches to come together and talk about it and actually connect with each other and share resources and their experiences. which was a great opportunity, and I hope this would continue and it will be replicated in different other areas around the country.
Speaking of evangelism, it's worth saying that FIC's partnered with A Passion for Life to fund their first director for ministry, and we're delighted that's been announced as Nick McQuaker, who's been an FIC pastor in the past and is serves in Hayward Heath. John, what's the relevance of that appointment? How will that help our churches?
Well, I think that's really, it's a hugely exciting step. We've wanted within FIEC to want to encourage and support local church evangelism. Andy Patterson, who was our mission director, served us for many years, helped us particularly with church planting. He retired last November. And we've been trying to think about how we can best invest in the ongoing work of evangelism through our churches. We were thinking about appointing somebody to come and work for FIEC on that basis. And then the Passion for Life mission happened. And I think I was involved in the very first Passion for Life. And it's interesting to see the way that it's morphed to become a sort of a ministry which has been more about promoting evangelism through local churches rather than sort of cooperative, organized event evangelism. And I think the last mission was hugely successful in that regard. I mean, a really good set of resources was produced, kind of videos, materials to help equip members of local churches for evangelism. So I think Passion for Life was itself developing. I've been a trustee of Passion for Life, and that kind of evolving into a way of equipping local churches for evangelism, working quite closely with Christianity Explored and Word One-to-One and other organizations as well. And the decision was taken that Passion for Life wanted to continue that work between the four-year kind of intensive mission cycles. And it just became clear that that was a way of serving both our churches and the gospel more widely. We're happy to work together with those who share our fundamental gospel convictions. Passion for Life has been a great way of gospel people kind of cooperating together. So we made the decision that we would help to fund the appointment of a director for Passion for Life, because we thought that would serve FIEC really well. The work Passion for Life is doing would become more integrated with FIEC and would help our churches to be better equipped, but it would also serve more widely than that. So where we can work cooperatively in a way that accomplishes more for the gospel, we're delighted to do that. So we're really excited that Nick was kind of appointed to that role. We'll be praying for him. We'll be praying for that work. We hope that this will be a benefit to all our 640 churches, that they'll want to make the most of these resources and the encouragement that's being provided for local church evangelism.
Fantastic. Let's dive then into some of the news stories of the last couple of weeks. I want to start by talking about Nigel Farage. Well, not particularly about Nigel Farage, but about his banking provision. So this is a story that's been running over the past couple of weeks. It seems that an arm of NatWest, I think it's pronounced Coots. I don't have anywhere near enough money to know how it's pronounced. But basically, they have stopped Nigel Farage from banking with them. That's led to a whole kind of hullabaloo in the news. Nigel Farage asked for his personal data, revealed that actually the reason that they removed his banking was not just because of the amount of money he held, which was initially reported, but actually because of his political views. And it's having wide-ranging implications, I think. So Dame Alison Rose has resigned from NatWest. Peter Flavel has stepped down from Coutts. We're in a position where this has all been laid bare, really, in recent days. And it's got wide-ranging implications, I think. Justin, you followed it quite closely. When the story first broke, You one of the first things you said to me was there might be more to it than just the amount of money.
Yeah. So basically, I started following this story of Nigel Farage when he basically broke earlier this month, beginning of this month, on GB News, that, you know, saying that he's been cancelled and stuff and all that. So at that point, even he wasn't sure, you know, what's the evidence. But actually, as the time went on, he found out there's more to it. And whether we agree with Nigel Farage's politics or not, but the thing is that it seems like he's got many lives. He finds issues and to stay relevant. So that's one of the things that he found out, picked up, and said, okay, he's going to fight this battle. Okay, yeah, he did that. And then in the process of that, the things that came out were quite in a way that are shocking. And in a way that, being a Christian, I think it is relevant to us that the views, that biblical views that we hold, if the society doesn't agree with that, especially we live in this such a strong corporate culture, who probably like to side with the popular views of the society, would probably not agree with our biblical values and our faith, would like to cancel us as well. So where we would go from there? So I think, whether we like Nigel Farage or not, but he's setting up some standards here. He's helping us to basically think that if we find ourselves in similar situations, how would we react? But I think another way, the way government reacted is quite positive as well. Don't want to give credit to Tories, but in a way. But I think it was in the wider context of our economy and the banking sector. Mm. You know, you need to give confidence to the investors that we are a good place to invest, whether they're coming, you know, local investors or coming from abroad, that our political views, our religious views, or they wouldn't cancel you, or the banking wouldn't cancel you, or we would not hold against you. I think that's very important. And that is was something that I will say, you know, being from IT, I always say when we are signing up or ticking boxes for Microsoft, Google, or whatever, we need to read those terms and conditions. Yeah. Quite often, those are contrary to our beliefs, our biblical beliefs. But what we know now, which Nigel Farage has led and helped us to look into, and draw those lines to say that you can't be that easily cancelled by big corporations. Mm. And I think that is quite significant.
I think it's important, isn't it? Because we have heard anecdotally that churches have been losing their banking provision and not being given reasons why. They don't have the same rights as an individual to ask for the reasons, because you can only make a subject access request about a person. John, what are the implications, do you think, more widely? Justin's put his finger on something there.
Well, I think the really big question here is, how do you deal with a society in which people have different views who disagree with each other? We're talking here about legal views that people hold, so they're not kind of views that would be sort of prohibited in any way. And the challenge is the provision of what you might call kind of commercial services that ought to be available to everyone, and how much can the providers of those services basically insist on, in a sense, imposing their values on their clients. And it's quite complicated because, of course, actually, most of the commercial sort of organizations now do want to proclaim their values. We are also in a consumer savvy culture in which basically, you know, online media protests against the ethics of banks and organizations. So you've got commercial entities that are driven by commercial pressure. Mm-hmm. They want to proclaim their values. And actually, if you look at most of the adverts on television now for big organizations, they're not really talking about the service. They're talking about the values of the organization. They want to show they're environmentally friendly. Obviously, the big issue there is gay pride. And virtually every major commercial organization is wanting to leap on the LGBTQ kind of rights, gay pride, show that they're friendly to those people from the gay community. And they feel that if they have clients who don't reflect those values, that will somehow undercut. I mean, the danger is a lot of that is hypocritical, because, of course, many of these organizations are working with people from around the world, from countries that make homosexuality illegal. They provide banking services to Saudi Arabia, to kind of Russian oligarchs. So, I mean, at one level, they're creating an impression that isn't the reality anyway. But the real question is, how on earth do you manage this kind of, in a sense, right to access to goods and services? And I think what's being revealed is there are certain protected characteristics. So under the equalities law, goods and services have to be provided in a non-discriminatory way where you're dealing with people with protected characteristics. So that's exactly why, for example, Christians can't run a hotel and refuse to offer a bedroom to a gay couple. Mm. The law requires them to make those goods and services available irrespective. They can't discriminate against people on the grounds of ethnicity or on the grounds of kind of gender. And interestingly, actually, religion is protected. Mm. So, for example, there was the case of Core Issues Trust, which was an organization seeking to help people, sort of Christians with same-sex attraction. Barclays withdrew their bank account from them. And actually, they're protected because that's a religious kind of position. In the end, Barclays had to settle on that and pay a significant sum of money. The problem is this sort of middle space of issues like political views, and outlooks that don't gain protection under the equalities legislation. So to remove Nigel Farage, in a sense, has no legal right to, in a sense, demand to have a bank account. And the things on which it was removed for are not protected characteristics. Mm. So I think society is having to wrestle with the fact that there is a diversity of values and views, diversity of political opinions, diversity of views on issues like homosexuality and whether you see it as being morally right or morally wrong. And we must remember there's a very significant section of the population that doesn't buy into the kind of the pride agenda. So something like 35% of people in London in a recent survey said they believe that homosexuality was a sort of immoral. And actually in certain ethnic groups, that's far more represented than in the majority white population. And liberal progressives like to think that everybody ought to adopt their views. But the reality is that for either cultural or religious reasons, there will always be a sizable minority of people who simply don't buy into those views. So how do we navigate the provision of goods and services in a way that doesn't discriminate against the values and the views that, that people might have? It seems that the government may well step in and provide some greater protection for these kind of views. I think that would be a good thing. These are commercial entities, and I think it's evident that banks are providing effectively a public service. Mm, everybody needs banking services.
Especially in this day and age.
Absolutely. You know, it's a quasi-public service that's brought in. After all, NatWest is 40% owned by the state that bailed it out. And for that reason, the idea that it's kind of discriminating against citizens because of perfectly legitimate views that they might hold is disgraceful, really. And I think, as with many things in this case, there was the original kind of failure, which was to withdraw the bank account from Nigel Farage. There's a certain irony in a bank kind of wanting to say how inclusive it is that requires you 3 million quid to kind of bank with it, that only basically operates with the very rich, and that 30 years ago was delivering documents in a horse-drawn carriage to Buckingham Palace.
I miss those days, John. I miss those days.
On one level, you kind of think the richness of the attempt to create a false image there is very deep. But there was that original offence. And then that actually, I think, was made worse by the cover-up. And again, so often, in situations where organisations have behaved badly or stupidly, it's the cover-up which is far worse than original failing. Mm. So, yeah.
And I would add, like, as Christians, you know, quite often we do get offended very easily. And kind of, for me, the freedom of speech is very important. Mm. You know, and you should be able to express your views and your opinion. We don't want to live in a society where we got thought police who would be reading our thoughts and, you know, we would be scared to express our thoughts. Mm. But at the same time, I think it's important as Christians for us to defend the views of the people who we don't agree with.
Yeah.
And basically, if we have to stand up for that at some point, you know, that's one reason is, you know, I'm part of a political party, is that I people who I don't agree with, I can sit down with them and basically say, yeah, I acknowledge your right and I'm willing to listen to them and whether I agree or disagree, but yeah, you got the right to say your things.
We want to live in a tolerant society, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, there's the different difficulty of drawing a boundary line, what's religion, what's not religion. So for example, I think there's the case of the Church of England vicar who had his bank account or account with Yorkshire Building Society removed because he protested against their position on transgender. Now, at one level, is that a political protest against transgender and an ideology, or is that a deeply held religious views because sort of he has convictions about the nature of what it means to be male and female and made in the image of God? And again, I think our society, this boundary line between is it a protected religious belief or is it sort of a different other value or political belief is actually really quite hard to draw. Mm, mm. And I think at one level, the direction of travel at the moment seems to be in favour of giving protection to a wider range of beliefs, which I think would be a good thing for Christians. It would help us. And I think this moment is a moment of opportunity for us to be able to speak. So Christians have, you know, being granted these protections, and very often sort of secular society has looked at those and said, you shouldn't have them. We don't like you having them. We want to take them away. You know, you're discriminating against people on grounds of, for example, sexuality. And then suddenly they find that they're discriminated against on the grounds of some of their beliefs. This may be a moment in which there is an opportunity for Christians to advocate for a much wider tolerance and acceptance of views that some people find offensive and that they disagree with. But that's what you have to do in a kind of a plural society in which you have a diversity of different views. So maybe there'll be a maturity of coming to terms with the reality of being in a mixed culture and how you have to work that out.
Let's stay with politics. Justin, you've said you're a member of the Conservative Party. How did the Conservative Party around here respond to the two by-election losses? And we'll come to the one that they won in Uxbridge in a minute. But was that expected? Was there great kind of deep disappointment? What was the kind of response to those two losses?
I think it was very much expected. These are by-elections. They, you know, quite often people vote against the ruling party. That's always been the trend.
It's a protest vote, right?
The protest vote, yeah, exactly. So it was very much expected, and especially looking at the status of our economy and inflation, it was very much expected. But when you really look in and break down the results, you see that it's not really a win for either Labour or Lib Dem. in a way that, you know, if you look at the two seats, Selby and Somerton, both of them basically, okay, one, the Selby one won by Labour Party. But when you look at where is Lib Dem in that, and you see Lib Dem way down, and then the same goes for the other one, Somerton and Fromm, Lib Dem won that. And if you look down, where's the Labour Party in that? And that, again, Labour Party way down. So it was a seat adjustment between two parties to go against the Conservatives, which is quite interesting, is that, you know, if there's a general election today, then I think most likely there will be a hung parliament. Mm. But again, there will be no clear winner. So I think looking at that, I think people haven't really made up their mind. Yes, there is, economy is the big issue, inflation is the big issue, but I think there is still a lot of time before the general election, and this tide can turn, I think, in favor of still Conservative Party.
Okay, there we are. You heard it first, ladies and gentlemen. So Justin Gill says the Tories can still win the next election. You heard it here first. But they did win the Uxbridge seat, which is probably the one that they ought to have lost, given that it was Boris Johnson's seat. But interestingly, that's being laid squarely at a kind of green policy that's come from the Labour mayor of London, ULEZ, ultra low emission zone, for driving. So that's led to a whole raft of thought that, oh, maybe then the green agenda is the problem and the Conservatives should back away from that. And then it's not quite clear where the Labour Party stand on how quickly they'd move towards net zero. Is that a fair assessment, John?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, two things are going on at the moment in the news. One is that we're recognising the reality of the impact of global warming. So that's in the news all the time. A kind of wildfires in Europe, very high temperatures.
Scary pictures.
Yeah, yeah. The kind of the evidence is the ice sheets are retreating extremely quickly. Numbers of scientists are saying that actually the prospect of keeping the temperature rise to 1.5% has already gone. It's too late to kind of do that. So at one level, we have the kind of the bigger climate picture that is being presented, which sort of seems to suggest that there's a greater risk. And actually, people generally recognize that risk. People are concerned about the environment and the future of a planet. Yet at the same time, there is this reaction against the pursuit of net zero, particularly within the UK, whether it be the proposal to kind of, in a sense, make petrol and diesel cars illegal in 2030, whether it be ULEZ. And I think there, the apparent unfairness of people who have older cars, often poorer people who can't afford to replace them, or businesses that have got vans that can't afford to replace them, effectively being charged £12.50 a day to kind of drive. And I think that sense of people's personal freedoms and ability to be able to, it just feels deeply unfair. Mm. And I think bound up with a lot of that is the sense of, will it actually make a great deal of difference? Because at one level, you know, all of this is sort of presented as we've got to do this in order to save the planet. But as Tony Blair pointed out in his lecture yesterday, actually what we do in Britain makes very little difference to the planet as a whole, because in the end, it's down to what China does, it's down to what India does. Our impact is minimal. In kind of global terms. And at one level, I think there's a resentment on the part of people that they're being forced to, as it were, set an example, but they don't actually have any conviction that really it will make any difference in solving the problem. So that seems to be the dilemma that we're in at the moment, is there seems the overwhelming evidence of the dangers to the climate. And yet at the same time, the difficulty of sort of deciding what's the right way to deal with that, what personal sacrifices do people make? I mean, obviously, people are heading off on holidays all over Europe or whatever. There's no doubt that air travel, for example, is one of the most significant contributors to kind of global warming. So it begins to impact on individuals' lives. To what extent should we make sacrifices and change for the sake of that? I think that's the kind of dilemmas that are opening up politically at the moment. And all of the parties seem to be reconsidering what they're going to sort of do.
How quickly they'll get there.
How quickly they'll get there.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing is that how fast and how quick you adopt. Looking at the example of Sri Lanka, who recently as a country went bust just because they went too fast, too quick, adopting the green policies in their farming, in their infrastructure and trade and everything. And basically, the country wasn't ready. The economy wasn't ready to take that much change and that quick. They made promises on international level that they're going to do it and they're going to set standards for the rest of the world and all these big claims. And what happened? They just nosedived. The economy nosedived. But I think at the same time, the same goes for us, that the 2030 deadline, I think it's not realistic. We are setting ourselves to fail rather than to succeed. Even European countries are saying, no, they want to extend it and all that stuff. But I think we really need to consider what price we are willing to pay to meet the deadline. And considering the status of our economy currently, how long it's going to take us to recover so that we can pay the bill to change our economy to a green economy.
Going to be a seminar at the Leaders Conference on this, isn't there, John? As Christians, what's a wise way of thinking about all this? Because we hear so many voices, both secular and Christian. What's a wise way for us to navigate?
Well, it seems to me that sort of virtually every ideology, in some sense, is a reflection of the Christian salvation story. They are sort of secular perversions of it at one level, or kind of copies of it. And I think that's true of environmentalism. Someone this week said environmentalism and climate change has become our new religion. I think that's absolutely right. There are elements in which it is a secular redemption story with its own story of fall, which is basically humanity developing technology, original sin, which is basically our use of kind of carbons and fuels that are going with that, an apocalyptic kind of end, which seeks to be avoided, and the need to obtain some kind of salvation from that, which actually can bifurcate in one of two ways. It's either a form of self-salvation in which we all work for salvation by sort of our own self-sacrifice, and the things we do will kind of bring about the better future and avoid that end judgment, if you can put it that way. Or alternatively, there's the miraculous savior kind of hope, which is that some technology will be discovered that will kind of solve the problem and we'll just simply be able to trust in that. So there are lots of ways in which it echoes kind of a Christian story. And I think that gives us points of contact. And I think we need to kind of, in a sense, recognize that it does have a quasi-religious sort of shape to it. And at one level, our story of salvation kind of relates to that. But we need to see it to some extent for what it is, that there is a sort of a secular salvation story being developed there. Having said that, as with all secular salvation stories, there's an element of truth to them, and we can bring the gospel to bear on them. So it seems to me that the evidence of risk to the climate it is one that's very real. I'm not one of those who wants to deny that there's global warming or deny that kind of human activity has contributed to that. It seems to me biblically God has created a good world, good for the whole of humanity, but that we were commanded that we have to take care of it. There are sort of intrinsic biblical principles, both from creation and the law, which kind of, in a sense, limit the way in which human development occurs, that it's not the case that you should necessarily pursue everything kind of no matter sort of what. So even in creation, the provision of the Sabbath is to some extent a limitation on kind of the full extent of our exploitation. We were created as human beings to rule in God's place. And I think the idea of fill and subdue, we're meant to populate the earth, we're meant to bring it into fruitful cultivation. But at the same time, we're to guard it and protect it, and we're not to exploit it. Again, you find some elements in the law in terms of environmental protection in the way that you sort of behave, the Sabbath years, the fallow land. There's a whole load of material which is basically about an element of caring for creation and recognizing our dependence upon God. So I think we can bring the gospel to bear on that. The Bible does call us to care for the world that God has given us, to recognize our utter dependence and fragility, that sense that could all go wrong. Well, yeah, absolutely. Because if we ignore the Creator and we don't live in His ways, then we inevitably ruin the world that He has established. So I think there is a Christian case for wanting to argue that we do need to take care of the planet on which we live. There's a recognition, though, that kind of human sin is very deep, human selfishness is very deep. And that our ultimate hope is not in the salvation of this world, but our ultimate hope is in the fact that God will recreate a new world, which sin will kind of be eliminated. So we in a sense, are called to do the right thing, but we shouldn't think that that is the means for salvation of humanity and of the world.
Politically, again, going back to the results of the by-elections, all three constituencies and the results says that the party at the third number is the Green Party.
So they've come in third after the top two.
So there's a danger for the top two parties that if they let go their green agenda, they might lose up some voters to Green Party. So yeah, there's always going to be this kind of political challenge, you know, way to how to draw the line and what policies to adopt and how to let it go. So I think Labour and Conservative, they are looking at each other the who would blink first and who would let it go, you know, and drop it and say that, okay, yeah, we're going to be flexible on this. So yeah, I think this is something to watch.
Well, we've got a couple of minutes left. And John, I want to talk about the film you went to see last night. You went to see Barbie. I'm joking, John. You went to see Oppenheimer. So you took a drink at just the wrong point then, brother, and nearly spat it out across the table. John didn't see Barbie. You went to see Oppenheimer. John, lots of parallels there, which can help us think wisely about our Christian walk. Just walk us through a couple of those as we close.
It's worth saying that when I was in the cinema, there was a large number of people there wearing pink who were there going to see Barbie. And we didn't go to see that. I think Oppenheimer had the smaller audience of the two films that were shown. It was a great film, Christopher Nolan's latest film. I thought it was really, really well done as a film. It is a great story. Again, it purports to sort of tell the experience of kind of Robert Oppenheimer, who was the father of the atomic bomb, led the Manhattan Project. You know, as with all films, there's elements to which there are historical inaccuracies in the way that it's portrayed. But I think it raises a whole lot of really interesting themes. At the heart of it, it's to really to do with the man's moral wrestling over the kind of making of the atomic bomb and the introduction of what in effect is a whole new age for humanity, that ability to be able to kind of destroy the world. And I think, Oppenheimer is presented as a rather conflicted kind of individual. It has multiple elements to it. Things that really particularly struck me was kind of teasing out the whole question of kind of the relationship between theory and practice. So he was a theoretical physicist. And obviously for him, the achievement of actually creating a bomb, making it work, that was a kind of the ultimate kind of outworking of scientific kind of theory. And then there was the kind of the wrestling with the actual use of it. So it was, you know, in a sense, there was a theoretical ability to be able to make a bomb, but whether you should use it or not. And I think that crossing over from theory into practice was a really interesting theme that ran through the film. I mean, in the end, in his moral struggles, I mean, he was challenged, you know, in effect, sort of somebody said to him, Oppenheimer, what you really wanted was you wanted Trinity, which was the demonstration of the first bomb in the kind of New Mexico desert, but you didn't want Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And you see something of his moral dilemma as he tries to persuade the authorities, firstly, not to drop the bomb, but merely to tell the Japanese that they have it. And then to want to discourage the development of the hydrogen bomb. And I think that that kind of moral tension between sort of theory and what it means in practice was developed through the film. I mean, it wasn't just in the atomic bomb. It was actually kind of developed in his own personal life. He was married, but was a womanizer. He had a mistress, a kind of affair with her. She killed herself. So again, you've got that theoretically kind of, you know, the idea of being able to just indulge your desires, but actually the reality in practice is kind of damaging. And he grieves over that. And you see him kind of, in a sense, wrestling with his own conscience. He tries to sort of say, well, I made the bomb, but it's not my decision to drop it. I can separate out the making of it from the dropping of it. And there's a sense in which much of the film focuses on the way his own security clearance is removed later. There's a sort of a sense of self-immolation on his part, of almost kind of, in a sense, wanting that as a way of atoning for the guilt that he feels for what he's done. So I think those themes of kind of theory and practice, the theme of guilt, moral responsibility, the question of whether and where you can find forgiveness in that are deeply kind of running through the film. And I think obviously from a Christian perspective, we can speak into all of those. And I think there are links with the whole climate thing. The whole nuclear kind of threat was the apocalyptic vision that we lived with primarily through the 60s through to the kind of end of the Cold War period. So at one level, we've moved from great fear of a sort of atomic apocalypse to kind of climate apocalypse. And I think the questions of theory and practice, again, are really interesting for some contemporary issues. So you see the kinds of moral wrestling that Oppenheimer was going through in relation to the atomic bomb is exactly what some scientists are now going through in relation to AI. So it's from me that there's that link there. Some of the creators of AI have been saying recently, you know, we wish he'd not developed this technology. Yeah. This has the capacity to destroy humanity. So theoretically, they wanted to do it as a theoretical exercise. But once it begins to happen, they see kind of the threat of it. The same is true, I think, with genetic engineering and some of the things that we're able to do there. And it raises the question of should you do what you can do? what limit is there to human technological development?
Yeah, just because you can do it doesn't mean that you should.
And what moral framework ought to kind of govern that? Mm. I think those are deeply significant questions to which the Bible has answers to bring to bear on it. So I think it's a thought-provoking film that speaks into the contemporary challenges.
Brothers, time has beaten us. I must say that has been some excellent Christian commentary on the Barbie film as well. So maybe we can put a couple of... maybe we can put a couple of links in the show notes about that. But John, Justin, thanks so much for chatting with us about the things going on in the news. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of FIEC. This has been Independence, the FIEC podcast. Do rate, leave a review so others can find it, and we'll speak to you again soon. God bless.
Thank you.